The success of autonomous vehicles depends heavily on predicting human behavior. How will the future car react when it pulls up behind a swarm of cyclists that are practicing for a race, or that neighborhood dog is chasing a squirrel is about to cross the road? Predicting human behavior accurately requires scientific modeling. You have to have both a thorough conceptual and mathematical understanding of how humans think, of how they react to situations, both the ones that we can imagine and the ones that we can't. Behind each of these models is an economist. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, Vice President of Strategic Automotive Initiatives at Siemens Digital Industries Software. And today, we're talking about how those models are created and what we can learn from them. So, in light of the current worldwide predicament, how can these models be used to help guide us through the pandemic? Our guest today is Ashley O'Donoghue, and she is a PhD economist at the Center for Healthcare Delivery Science at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center right here in Boston. Welcome to the show, Ashley. Now, many out there that listen to the Future Car Podcast might find it odd that during a pandemic, I'm actually interviewing an economist. But there's plenty of good reasons why and where that came from.
People have said to me, they say, well, why are you interviewing an economist that's working on a pandemic for the Future Car Podcast?
It's a great question.
Yeah, it is. And the reason is autonomous cars, suddenly you're replacing this human with this very powerful computer in their skulls with computers that are going to try and do all the reasoning and perception. And the world is uncertain. There's so much uncertainty and knowing what to look for and how to combine information to figure out what the right thing is to do. And also trying to predict, you know, is that person going to jump off the curve? Do I have to worry about this or that? So there's so many parallels. I want to start off and just talk to you a little bit about, in general, what you do, who you are, what you do. How did you get to the point where you became a PhD economist at the Center for Healthcare Delivery Science at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center?
I was never the kind of person who, I guess, knew what they wanted to do growing up. And when I got to college, I really liked math, so I majored in math. But I didn't know what I was going to do with that. And then I took an econ class just because I had to for a requirement, and I realized it was pretty much just all math, but applied. So then I picked up a second major in economics. And then when I was a senior, I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. And my advisor was like, you should apply to grad school. And I was like, yeah, I don't really want to get a job. So then ended up
That's
in
a good
PhD.
Thing to do, right?
Yeah.
It could be like a vacation, maybe, grad school, right?
It didn't end up being very vacation-like. It was tough. So then I did my PhD, and I had worked at the Healthcare Center for Healthcare Delivery Science at BIDMC as a research fellow while I was in my PhD. And I really liked it there. And I guess they liked me. So that's how I ended up there full-time.
So you sort of fell in love with this whole idea of healthcare and economics coming together.
Yeah, I just ended up working there for one summer originally, just as, you know, a research fellowship. And it ended up being really interesting. I really think I really found my place.
So you specialize in causal inference.
Yes.
What is that?
So causal inference is really thinking about, did some event cause another event? So a lot of research that you see, it'll talk about associations, like smoking is associated with heart disease, or obesity is associated with all of these other problems. But actually determining whether one thing causes another is a lot harder because there are a lot of other things that go into that.
Did A cause B, or is there an A, B, and C that caused D, or are we missing something? I guess it's trying to understand those kind of relationships, it sounds like.
Exactly. I had a teacher that gave a really good example, my macro teacher in grad school. He said in the summertime, people eat a lot of ice cream, and there's a huge uptick in the number of people that drown. So eating ice cream and drowning are associated with one another, but eating ice cream doesn't cause you to drown. It's just that summertime is in there, and you have to make sure you take that into account. You can't say eating ice cream
will make you drown. How about if you eat ice cream while swimming? Does that have an impact on drowning?
Probably.
How do you make being an economist fun?
I mean, I think the things that you learn in a classroom of economics are a lot different than the things that people who do economics actually do. I do research on COVID, but there's people who study economics and they study the effects of incarceration or people getting out of jail. They study the effects of labor markets, minimum wage. There's a lot of stuff about environmental law and environmental science that goes into economics if you want to be an environmental economist. There's lots of different areas and it overlaps with so many different things that you can really kind of do whatever you want. There's the economics of cybersecurity, lots of cool things.
Here's the big question. What is an economist doing in the healthcare business? I don't think of an economist and healthcare being the same thing. There was, used to be an old skit on Saturday Night Live. There was this guy called Father Guido Sarducci. Have you ever heard of Father Guido Sarducci?
No.
Maybe not. Anyways, so Father Guido Sarducci had the 5-minute university. And in 5 minutes, he would give you like 5 different degrees, engineering, whatever, you know, sociology. Anyways, one of his degrees was in economics. And it was really quick. He said, when supply equals demand, that's what's most important. Nothing else you need to know. So that's like sort of the basics, right? Like, okay, supply, demand, the economy, that's what people think. But it's more than that, right? Because somehow an economist and healthcare were made to work together, it sounds like.
Definitely. I think, you know, a lot of goals in United States healthcare is how do you deliver the best care that you possibly can and also make it cost effective, which are two very opposing things. So I don't directly do a lot of things with the money and the costs of things, which I think is a misconception about economists. You don't really deal with money a lot.
We want to measure what is it we could do to make things better or what's making things worse, I guess.
Exactly. So, and in hospitals too, you have a lot of what's called natural experiments, which are things that economists are really good at. If you have a natural experiment, it makes it really easy, not easy, but it makes it easier to think about the causal effects of things. So when something just happens by chance, like if there's a shortage of some kind of drug and some hospital doesn't have access to that drug, do people who go to that hospital end up worse off than people who go to another hospital that have that drug? But you'd have to take into a lot of things like maybe you just look at people who are delivered by ambulance and say, are they quasi-randomly assigned to a hospital? And then could we say, people who needed access to this drug who either got it or didn't, was it beneficial? So does this drug work in that kind of sense?
What makes a good model of the pandemic?
I think that there are really specific models that are rooted in epidemiology that and infectious disease that are known to be good at modeling the progression of a disease. Those would be like it's what's called a susceptible, infected, and recovered model. So if you took Massachusetts, for example, it would model the population of Massachusetts. They're all susceptible in the beginning. And at some rate, people become infected depending on how contagious the virus is, how much people are coming into contact with each other, things like that. And then people are infected for some number of days and they're infecting other people too. And then at some point they recover. So it models how the population moves through those stages. And that's really rooted in epidemiology and infectious disease. Those are the kinds of models that I think have been the most successful at modeling the pandemic.
So you would base your pandemic model on, say, existing models that already do this type of classification, say, of people in the community, in the population?
Definitely. So you would probably take that kind of model and then you would tweak it for the pandemic. So one really important thing for this pandemic is social distancing. So you would want to incorporate that parameter into an SIR model. You would want to say, well, we know that people are either staying at home, or maybe they aren't staying at home as much as they should be. So you'd want to take an SIR model and then say, how can we adapt this? And the answer would be adding social distancing among a bunch of other things that you would probably want to add.
Mm-hmm. And you sent me this thing by the United States Daily COVID-19 from 5/4/20. And these are their very words. To better visualize observed data, we are also continually updating a curve-fitting exercise to summarize COVID-19's observed trajectory. Tell me, in the light of a good model and a bad model, is this a good model? It seems to me like it might not be so good.
So curve fitting exercises are, I think it's how people intuitively want to approach things when you're predicting something, but it's really not appropriate in a pandemic. So when you're modeling a curve, if you want to do a curve fit exercise, you need to be 3/4 of the way through the curve, perhaps, or farther enough across the peak to be able to use that kind of method. But you're definitely not able to do that early on. You can't curve fit, especially curve fitting on something like deaths, which is really noisy, is really not a good idea.
So when you're curve fitting, you're basically trying to predict the future based on a particular characteristic or combination of characteristics that occurred in the past.
Right. And so one way that you could do that is by looking at other countries, and you could say, well, if China and Italy have gone through their curves, can we project that onto the U.S.?
Can you?
In principle, you would think, yeah. But in reality, not really. The scenarios in Italy and China are so different. You can't project that onto America, where, you know, China, they had a lockdown that was a true, complete, like, lockdown. And, you know, there are also questions about whether, how is the data collected? Is it collected the same as we would collect it? So definitely you can't project data from China onto the U.S. because their lockdown was entirely different than ours. That's not something you can do. Italy, it's a little bit different. I think that they locked down, depending on the region of the U.S., a little bit later than we did, which is why they had a bigger peak. And then they also just have different demographics. I think a lot more people probably live in the same households. Like, it might be more multi-generational. You would know this better than I would. It might be more multi-generational households and things like that than in America. So that's going to be really huge for the transmission of the virus.
But, you know, you're actually right. So coming from an Italian household, right, with two parents that are Italian, my grandma lived with us, and my grandpa and my aunt lived next door, exactly. And my other uncle, and it's, we're constantly together every night and this and that. And that's just one example of a cultural difference that could have a big impact on the model as to why a simple curve fit from Italy will not apply to the United States or to China. Are the models much better now than they were, say, 3 weeks ago at predicting when this is going to level off and we can get to the, as they say, the new normal?
Definitely. I think one of the problems with this pandemic is that you don't really know what you're dealing with. So one of the biggest things that you're putting into an SIR model is, if you want to model hospitalizations, you need to know how many people are infected and what percent of them are hospitalized. And if there's A, not a lot of testing, and B, a ton of asymptomatic people walking around, you don't know. So I think early on in the pandemic, people were thinking, well, out of all the people that are tested, about 20% are hospitalized. Well, testing is really biased. Obviously, only the sickest people were getting tested in the beginning. And then you think, well, maybe like 5% are being hospitalized, but that's still really high. And now we have lots of antibody testing and stuff like that. We realize there's a lot more people infected than we thought, which means the hospitalization rate is much lower than was originally thought. Still really high and still overwhelming hospitals. But when you don't know those things, you have to try to make the best guess. And then you learn as you go, and those things are going to change in your model.
When it comes to cars in the past, let's say pre-autonomous cars, right? The good old days. What they do is they take a car and it becomes safe when it passes the federal crash test. If you have an autonomous car, how do you know that control system in the sensor suite is actually good enough? In other words, you're going to have to test that control system against some model, and then you're going to declare, this car is safe to deploy on your streets. It's very similar to saying, well, Ashley's model or Washington's model or someone's model says everything's okay now. Go ahead and move forward. How do you know when to say that?
I think it's difficult. You do what's called validation. So you build your model. Okay. And then you say, how well, if we looked at what our model said on Sunday, how well did it predict this week? Was it really close to predicted? Was there a lot of errors? And then you say, could it predict 2 weeks out? And then you would also want to think about, you know, if you built a model for Boston, maybe you want to look at how would this model have performed in New York? How did it perform in Connecticut? How would it have performed out of sample? Things are different in different areas, but if you had mobility data for those different areas and you knew when the first person was infected, the information about the virus should be the same. So the doubling time should be the same at baseline, and all those other things should be the same. So you should be able to, if you had mobility data and other data in these areas, you should be able to take your model, put it in a different place, and see, did it perform here well too? And if it did, then that's a good sign.
Do they travel to the new place, or do they still work, I guess you're saying, right?
Right. So do your predictions hold? Does your model hold? And is it able to predict out of sample, which is important, because when you build a model, one concern is it just fitting the data that you have? And then is it going to not do well in the future, which is called overfitting? So maybe it would be like, you know, a little kid who learns to read a book but memorizes the book. They couldn't actually read another book. They could read that book to you because they memorized it, but they couldn't read another book. you want to make sure your model can read another book and hasn't just memorized your book.
You know, Ashley, you can't have a discussion about the future car and autonomous cars without talking about AI. In fact, you almost can't have a discussion about anything without talking about AI, it seems like these days. How does AI help you do what you're doing?
So I work with Dr. Steve Horn, who he works at the Center for Healthcare Delivery Science. So he does a lot of machine learning and AI stuff. And so that's really useful because you can learn parameters from the data. So things that we don't know, like hospitalization rates, and we don't know how many people are really infected and things like that, because there's not adequate testing, you can learn that information. And that makes it a lot better than just either taking a best guess at those things, which is what a lot of other models have done in prior to like the early stages of the pandemic, where you were maybe assuming, say, 5% of people are being hospitalized, but you know that's actually not the case. But now with now that there's a lot more data, you can use the machine learning AI to just learn those parameters from the data without actually having to know them. You don't have to test people. You can just learn them.
Did these AI techniques ever make something pop out to you that you say, wow, I never would have thought of that?
It really just solidified the realization that social distancing is the most important thing and really affects the model the most. Because once you get the mobility data and you no longer have to learn those numbers and you can actually see how people are performing, you realize how important that was. You know, a model's a lot better when you don't have to necessarily learn that information and you can just input it, and then you can, you know, use your model to focus on really the parameters that we don't know, like hospitalization rates and infection rates.
It's helping you build confidence then, right? Yeah, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Can you predict when you're going to have a certain level of uncertainty based on the nature of how a pandemic or whatever is unfolding?
I think to a certain extent now we have a lot of information to be able to make fairly accurate predictions. The problem is with this kind of thing going forward, the most important driver is social distancing. And when that changes, you know, I can predict a model based on today's social distancing levels, but that would assume that people keep social distancing. And that's probably not going to happen. Once things start reopening, the social distancing levels are going to change. So to the extent that I can predict how are people going to behave in the future, we can get pretty close. The issue is, how are people going to behave?
So I would think that the data that we start to collect in the next week or two that may be influenced by that behavior would probably give you a way to start adjusting your models for impact of social distancing. So.
Definitely. So like there's lots of data on cell phone locations and GPS locations of where are people moving, where are their cell phones moving rather than not people. How are they coming into contact with other people? What businesses are they going to? And you can monitor this every day when they release their data, and you can see, are people still social distancing? Are they becoming a little more relaxed about this? But monitoring that is really important because that's going to be the biggest driver of how this thing progresses. And it's hard to know what people are going to do.
Social distancing, how much should I weigh that in? Or another factor, you know, how do you figure out? Because I think there, who knows, maybe economists could have some lessons that programmers for autonomous cars could consider in trying to figure out, should I weigh that in or not? Which one is the more important? How do you go about figuring out the relative importance and the weighing there of these different factors?
I mean, in terms of social distancing, that one's really easy to, if you take your model after you've kind of set all your parameters and everything, and you just say, we know what social distancing is now. What if we go back to normal and you put that in and you see what happens and it's not good at all? What would happen? And then you say, well, what if we kept social distancing really well? And that's going to drive the curve down and eventually, you know, the pandemic will end. And what if you're somewhere in between? And what are the different levels of in between is looking at those different scenarios. You know, you may not be able to say with 100% certainty, this is what's going to happen with the pandemic. But you can say, if people behave in certain ways, this is what we'll see.
The pandemic is actually changing some thinking here. Milan, for instance, said that they've learned from the pandemic, and in this new normal, they want to make sure that people that want to walk and ride bicycles have more room to do what they do. And so they're going to take away lanes from cars and give it to people. In Indianapolis, they're actually closing down sections of street so that restaurants can move all their tables outside.
Wow.
Right? I would imagine then your modeling focus is going to shift to predict, whoa, if you shut down streets, and put tables in streets, then that's a good thing to do, or it's not a good thing to do. It had this impact here or there. Do you see the modeling evolving to modeling the new normal and how to get that new normal to accelerate quicker back to a normal that we're more familiar with?
Definitely. I think a lot of the modeling now is looking at what can we do to return to normal while still making sure we're being careful. And I think a lot of that is what businesses are safe to go to, which ones are less safe, and how can we make them safer? And I think a lot of that will have to do with, you know, how dense they are, the kind of traffic that goes there, the airflow. So being outside, if you can, like restaurants serving food outside, I think that's definitely a step that a lot of places are taking, or several states are starting to take. That's definitely something that people are thinking about a lot in their modeling. And if we do let up social distancing, but we have these restrictions, what will that look like?
Have you thought much about the modeling that you're doing of the pandemic and is how it's coupled to transportation or the impact it's going to have on transportation? Does that come into play in any of the things that you think about?
I think in Massachusetts, when the T opens up again and the trains start, or I mean, it is open, but when people start really using it more, that's going to be really important, because then you have a lot of people really densely in a place that could be kind of an area that would be conducive to spreading COVID. So I think rethinking a lot of ways that people travel is probably going to be important. And I don't know if that means less people using transportation, more people maybe just working from home in general, or more people choosing to drive. But I don't think I know yet, but I imagine that we'll probably see a lot of research coming out in the near future about how people deal with that.
So recently, you were in the MIT COVID-19 Datathon.
Yeah. Thank you for watching.
Well, and congratulations for being one of the winners. Was it successful? Do you think it was a worthwhile experience? Do you think we got some good things out of that that might help us deal with the pandemic?
I saw a lot of interesting projects. There was one that looked at the effect of policies, and there was one that looked at shelter in place policies, and there was another that looked at prisons. Those two were really interesting, I thought. And then ours, we looked at super spreader businesses. So we built an index to classify businesses into super spreaders. And so that way we can monitor traffic to these businesses.
Super spreader. The first time I heard that term was when I learned about your talk. So of course, Google, and super spreader is someone that would spread a disease readily.
Yeah. So it's individuals or places that infect a lot of people. So if you think about like the Biogen conference in late February in Boston, that's considered a super spreader event, or meatpacking plants have been seen as a super spreader location.
So tell us about your application of your analysis of the super spreader. Super spreader businesses, that is, right?
Yeah. So I worked on a team. It was myself, one of the biostatisticians that I work with at the Center for Healthcare Delivery Science, her name's Tenzin, and then Manvi, Whitney, Michael, and Garba are data scientists. So we all worked together and we built this index to classify super spreader businesses. And it's still something that we're working on to this day. We took a bunch of data on traffic to businesses, and we can look at how many people were visiting businesses before the pandemic. How often were they visiting? How long were they staying? How densely packed in the businesses were they? Was there open airflow in these businesses? Do they have outside seating? Things like that. If we take all those things into account, we can kind of build an index to say, these are businesses where maybe people are really densely packed for a long period of time, and they may be more likely to spread the virus if someone there were to be infected. And so we built this index, and then we could classify businesses into super spreaders.
Describe to me the perfect super spreader business, or maybe I guess the right way to say it is the worst kind of super spreader business.
Yeah, so that's going to be a place where you're spending a lot of time there and you're really densely packed in and there's not a lot of airflow. So there's either no outside seating or it's all indoors, something like that. When you classify all the different types of businesses that are in New England, really the ones that come up the most are food, retail, all those things that we're looking to reopen in the coming phases of lifting up the shelter-in-place orders.
They're the worst ones, it sounds like.
Yeah, so that's why it's really important to think about, you know, can we open restaurants and have outside options, things like that, because they are, which isn't to say you should not go there, it's just to say you should, just being aware of those things are useful so that you can be in and out, or you can go when it's less busy, or you can make sure you sit outside, things like that. And just keeping track of the traffic to these businesses to know, are people still packing themselves in really densely into these areas? That's going to be really important to keep track of over time.
So tell you what, one last thing. if you're at a party, somebody comes up and says, Ashley, what do you do? What are you going to say?
I try not to tell people I'm an economist because then people want to like ask, well, what should I invest in? It's like, right. I don't know. I have no idea.
We're back to our original conversation now, aren't we?
Yeah. Should I buy cryptocurrencies? I don't know, man.
All right. So traditionally on the Future Car podcast, the final question is usually the same for everyone. Now, in the future, these autonomous cars, you're not going to be driving. Right? Driving is done. So you're just going to be in a car, and we call it the living room on wheels, right? You could do anything you want. So in the future, 2040, here you are. You're driving from Boston to New York in your living room on wheels, right? It could be anything you want it to be. And that includes like a 3D hologram of your favorite, you know, celebrity or economist or football player or whatever, right? It could be anything you want. What is your dream autonomous car living room on wheels experience as you travel from Boston to New York? Yeah, 2.5 hours. What do you want to do in your living room on wheels?
I mean, I feel like I'm biased because of the pandemic, but I think I would love like just a screen to be able to talk to all my friends that are all over the world because everyone graduates their PhD and goes everywhere. But I feel like that would be a good opportunity to like catch up with people. And yeah, that would be cool if you could just Zoom from your car, but have it be fancy and futuristic.
And we could add like a refrigerator or a bar, whatever you want to that. And we could have it. And us at Siemens will work on this for you. And our customers, we use our great software to design for you a surround screen that's the roof and the windows and everything so you can see all your friends life size. Does that sound good?
That sounds perfect.
Thanks, everybody out there, for joining us today. And a big thanks, of course, to Ashley O'Donoghue. For more information about Siemens Digital Industry Software, visit us online at plm.automation.siemens.com. And until next time, this has been the Future Car Podcast.